All right, Your Honors, this case comes to you as a First Amendment conspiracy case. It's an unusual case because what is this counsel's interpretation after 30 years of experience of what the Internal Revenue Service was pursuing in this case was an effort to work and make a First Amendment exception to the income tax laws. I stood before this court 15, 20 years ago in a case with the Fifth Amendment, United States versus Trocher, in which the court held there was no Fifth Amendment exception to the tax laws for the IRS.
Are you talking about an instruction to the petit jury or an instruction to the grand jury?
On the issue of the First Amendment, I'm starting off my argument by trying to give a background of I'm going to make a distinction here between what I think the government's argument is going to be on commercial speech that has no protection.
My concern is this, that I don't think there is any right to an instruction to the grand jury. It would just be the petit jury where there might be a real issue. So I want to sort out in my own mind what we're talking about.
You caught me completely by surprise, but I think I understand where you're coming from. It can become an issue with a petit jury, a First Amendment violation, if you're submitting to them the issue of whether the speech resulted in sudden, imminent, and criminal lawless action, such as under Brandenburg. I've never seen what you're talking about the grand jury being instructed, but I haven't seen any case law that says the grand jury doesn't have to be instructed. So that's probably something I missed, but I came along after they were indicted.
Okay, now I understand.
I never made any motion that said that the indictment was improper because the grand jury was improperly instructed on the First Amendment.
Mr. Eisen, maybe you can help me with the roadmap on this. You have placed a really large number of issues before the court. There's obviously not time to cover but a small fraction of them. What are you going to focus on?
I'm going to try to focus on the First Amendment.
Okay, very
because
well.
It's a big hole to dig out of.
Okay, very good.
And I'm familiar with the court's decision in Alvarez, and
I'm
I want to strike this
one.
Balance here. You have Dahlstrom, which I argued years ago to Judge Ferguson. That was a commercial speech case.
Mm-hmm.
You have arguably Freeman and Schiff, which are
well, Alvarez, of course, dealt with a situation where the person got no benefit whatsoever. It doesn't apply where the court has said the First Amendment does apply, where there's possible perjury or fraud or any benefits are derived. So
let
that doesn't really
that
help you there.
Let me jump on that immediately.
Okay, please.
The
do.
Benefit my client got was the benefit you would get if you were an author and you were reciting information and you got $30 or $40 for your book. And you recited in there how the IRS reacted to certain filings people had made. You recited in there about how the IRS reacted when they gave people certain letters. You acted informationally and reported it. And you got a $40 book fee. Now, there were some other issues here about selling of a trust for $500, which had some benefit to the taxpayer beyond taxes.
Well, let's stick with your $40 analogy. That's $40. I agree it's not very much, but it's something.
Well,
that's not Alvarez. That's not Alvarez.
My distinction is the $40, you look at it, and that money is going to informational report. That money is not the thousands of dollars that you get from the big law firm, Jenkins and Gilchrist, that goes bankrupt because it planned people's taxes with it. That money is not even the $200-$300 somebody gets that sits down and prepares returns. And I want to point this out. In Freeman, they prepared returns. In Schiff, they prepared returns. My client did not prepare any returns. Now, there was, within the ambit of group of the publishers here, a Teresa Giordano, which...
Are you saying that there's nothing more here than advocacy? Is that basically what you're saying?
It's not that simple, unfortunately, Your Honor. There's a couple of things the government can try to stab me with. Number one, there is advocacy. But number two, somebody within my client's organization was letters to IRS for people.
But they aren't helping people falsify tax returns. That's what you're saying.
No, they're not helping. And I'm going to jump on it specifically and tell you they're not helping them with sudden and immediate.
Aren't your clients giving people a roadmap as to how to falsify their tax returns?
The answer to that is that's what the government claims. But I say that doesn't make any difference. I don't think the evidence supports that. But let's look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict and say, let's assume the evidence supports that. They still didn't get over the sudden imminent criminal action in Brandenburg that was cited in Alvarez by the panel in the in-bank court here. And that is that there was at least 3 weeks delay between the time any of the government's witnesses read this book and they went and filed any return that the government objects to. There's no evidence in this case.
That's pretty imminent as far as filing a return goes. I mean, if you sell a book that advocates some illegal act and the person buys the book in 1986 and that then 5, 10 years later, when the issue comes up for them, they look at their old book and act on it. Well, there I can see where you'd have a First Amendment defense, but my gosh, it takes quite a lot of time to prepare a tax return. 3 weeks doesn't sound like much.
Well, nobody ever threw me that pitch, but what I'll tell you is that I swing and I'm going to hit it because I'm going to tell you that 3 weeks is too long for sudden imminent criminal action.
Unless, is there a bright
unless you want to write a commercial exception and say, over here we have sudden immediate action, fire in the theater, and everyone says, and runs out and tramples the neighbor next to him, knocks the popcorn down, tramples the baby and all that.
Some
versus
some criminal actions like tossing a Molotov cocktail in the theater can be accomplished fast. And some criminal actions, like a lot of kinds of fraud, can't be accomplished fast. So, and filing a nonsense tax return is in the latter category. You just can't do it that fast. So I'm still wondering why 3 weeks is not imminent.
If you want to craft that exception, I'm cooked, because that's my record. But I disagree with you. It's very dangerous to craft that exception on imminent and lawless activity.
Give me more. It's not like punching somebody or throwing a Molotov cocktail. It takes more time than that to do the criminal work.
No one has ever said, we are going to give the government a First Amendment exception because it takes a little longer for somebody to commit a criminal action because this is taxes. You are working your way to a First Amendment exception for the Internal Revenue Service. If this panel wants to give it to them, I can't stop them. But I argue vehemently against it.
What do
not need it. They don't have the right to it.
Mr. Eisen, what would be the bright line rule that you would urge upon this court then, since what we say will be in black and white and theoretically relied upon by others? If it's 3 weeks is too long, what would be imminent in the context of a tax return? And I agree with Judge Kleinfeld. This is not something that happens as immediate as one throwing a Molotov cocktail in a crowded theater. So would 2 weeks be imminent or 1 week? Or what kind of bright line rule are you urging?
I would give you this bright line. You sit down with a person, what you utter to them is going on their tax return.
So basically, book doesn't apply.
I could if I sat down with this and I said, you know what, I've got me a good manual here to do somebody's phony tax return here. Let's go over this now and let's fill out your return.
You're saying that they have to take the book and walk through it and instruct them through the book. You can't just have the book out there independently without the intermediary.
One of the reasons for the sudden immediate and the heightened scrutiny test that Judge Ferguson and the other judges applied in Dahlstrom to the commercial speech, that was a seminar, was simply when they acquitted the defendants on appeal, they looked at it and they said that there was some unclear law, which we have, but also they said you had to put the sudden and imminent test to it. That's your law. No one's reversed Dahlstrom. Contrary to what the government continues to claim in these cases, it hadn't been reversed. And the Freeman and Schiff don't help them because they sat down with people. I'm representing that to the court. I read those opinions. They sat down with people. They soaked money out of them, much more than a book, and they gave them direct tax advice, which is covered by 72061 in the Internal Revenue Code, which has counseled and prepared false income tax return for another. I think that's 72062 of 26 U.S.C. Now, with that in mind, the court is wrestling now with a situation where somebody lied. It's going up to the Supreme Court about their valor. Well, did my client lie about taxes? Well, I don't think so. My client, what she reported was simply what the IRS sent the client and the people the client knew. They sent out letters with codes on them, the IRS codes that come from their computer codes. When you read the codes, and this was testified to in trial, they said the codes meant the person wasn't required to file. The way the IRS explained that mistake was, well, we relied on what the people told us, and then we sent them the letter that said that they weren't required to file. And then you had the thing about the trust. You had the Feldhaus letter, who was a high official in the IRS Bensalem campus, they call it, that classified foreign returns. And you had another guy named Stacy Williams, who was responsible for classifying entities. He was the director over in Austin, the highest guy to classify entities for the purposes of the service center about what returns they should file and what EIN numbers you should get. You know what they both said? They said that trust was the type of entity that had no filing requirements under the income tax code. But that's what they said, and I quoted that in the letter.
But didn't they later correct that or send a subsequent letter saying, no, that's not the case once upon further investigation?
No, it's not that clear. The answer is the government searched around the trial and found a letter that mentioned another type of trust, and then they ran it in trying to say, oh, we corrected our mistake. But the problem is that if there was any mistake under United States versus Bishop, mistakes in under Dahlstrom, which quoted it, Dahlstrom's Ninth Circuit, Bishop is U.S., under our system of taxation, a mistake, negligence, gives rise to only civil penalties, not criminal indictments and punishments. So to answer your question, thank you for that opportunity. The answer is no, they never corrected their mistake by this record. But even if they had, it wouldn't make any difference. They made this case the stuff of which criminal convictions with a 10-year sentence should not have been made. And that's the thrust of the argument here on the appeal. And let me give you the other panoply here. You have Teresa Giordano.
Could you back up for a second? I'm still turning over your First Amendment argument in my mind because you have some significant points there. And I want you to tell me what in the indictment and what in the instructions permitted the jury to convict based upon the book.
Well, for one thing, Alicia Villarreal, the prosecutor, got up and said, you don't have to worry about this First Amendment issue about sudden imminent criminal lawless action. She argued that, and we argued that as prosecutorial misconduct, but that's just an example.
Okay, that's the answer is argument.
The judge, Pregerson, viewed this case in such a manner that he made an announcement to us at sentencing, which
my question. I wanted to know what count of or paragraph of the indictment to look at and what instruction to look at to find where the jury might have convicted any of these people just for writing and distributing a book.
The indictment has the language that said they counseled the filing of frivolous tax returns. And to me, I mean, that's clear enough. I could find other areas. But look at that. That's the means for the mail fraud and the means for the conspiracy.
Counseled the filing of frivolous tax returns doesn't say they're being indicted for writing a book. Where in the instructions?
Well, they're not going to say they indicted him for writing a book. Well, it's going to be subsumed in the language in the indictment that the book is included in what they claim they did, was counseled. You counsel with the book that you publish, according to the IRS.
The evidence had a lot more than the book, though.
A lot more than a book? I've tried to get to that, and I will if I have enough time to explain it. There's some other aspects of this organization. It's not just a book.
There was
a seminar, and there was letters written to the IRS by
Mr. Did any instructions say that they can be convicted for the book alone? And did you submit an instruction that the court rejected saying they cannot be convicted for the book alone?
We didn't concentrate, I don't believe, on book alone. What you're specifying reminds me of the deal where they say the mere failure to file a tax return is criminal negligence, but it can't support the felony. The answer is no, we didn't distinguish between the book in that manner that you're talking about. What we did was we asked for instruction on sudden and imminent criminal lawless action. We asked for First Amendment instruction. We did submit it. And here's what the judge told us. And he outlines what he ruled later in sentencing. He said that this case was disturbing, that it might be protected conduct, and he was going to issue a jury a First Amendment instruction, and he did. And that's rare in the cases that you get in tax and on criminal cases, and he gave the jury an instruction which resulted in the prosecutorial misconduct I'm talking about, where they argue against the instructions in front of the jury.
Which number instruction is that?
That I don't have, Your Honor. I don't have it memorized where I can give you the number. This is a huge record. I'm sorry. I will send you a letter and give you anything you want that I have stated.
Don't send us letters unless we ask for them.
I understand. Well, I understand that. The other aspect of this alleged conspiracy, one of them, was the sending of letters. And that was in the context of people asking for a collection due process hearing. They were coming after people that had read the book, and they came and they asked for help. The letters are nothing more than an appeal to the administrative remedies, which are also protected under the First Amendment, under the right to petition the court, and under open courts provision and all that under the First Amendment. You can't keep people out, and you can't punish them. The limits of your ability to punish them is sanctions for frivolous activity. You can't keep them from filing, and you sure can't criminalize it. And so there was one seminar, but the seminar is just speech. And nobody ever said she went behind the scenes back there behind that curtain, took $1,500, $2,000, and prepared our tax returns for each one of us or anything like that. It was pure speech that was at this seminar that was admitted. So you had her books admitted into evidence. Now, this addresses your point. Books were admitted as criminal evidence. And books were objected to for being admitted as criminal evidence. And that's in the record, very clearly. The video was objected to, and the court wouldn't let all of it in. Time and memory fades when it's 2004, and you're here in 2012 arguing a case. I remember some of this like yesterday, and some of it I don't remember as well. But the point is, that's what you have. You have the book, you have the video, you have the trust, and you have the writing of letters, basically. And those letters told the people about the trust that they had no income tax filing requirements. I want to make it clear what that means. In our tax system, if you have no filing requirements, you have no tax liability. And why is that? Because we're a voluntary system. That means everybody gets together, and the law criminally requires them in the first instance to figure out what their taxes are that they owe and write the government a note that says, I owe these taxes, and send them in under penalties of perjury. So you have that situation there, and so you have to, in the first instance, put it on a return. If you don't have to file a return, you don't have a tax liability under our system. So they didn't correct that, contrary to what they say, and it's just brushed aside, and people get sentenced. Some spend 3 years in jail, some spend two. One person, Carl, who was already affirmed by this court, I was not his attorney, he got 2 or 3 years in jail, and they wrote him a specific letter and told him that the tax return didn't have to be filed. And then there's this idea about Social Security numbers for bank accounts. Well, guess what? The EIN letter that was written, if you investigate that and look at it very carefully, you'll see that they were refusing to give EIN numbers to these trusts. They're refusing to give EIN numbers to them, and so therefore they couldn't open bank accounts. Why was that?
So,
because
wait,
if they didn't have a number, they couldn't have an account.
It's permissible then to give a false Social Security number to open a bank account, that's okay.
No, that's not what was proven in this case. That's not okay.
But the government
referred to the Social Security number, and they weren't given to the bank as a Social Security number. That was called a trust identification number, and the bank did that so the bank could get the money from the depositors when the feds wouldn't give them an EIN number. And I say they wrote that letter to try to keep people from using those trusts, and it backfired on them.
Counsel,
that's what I tell you.
That EIN number would be given to a trust. Now, you used the term true trust.
No, pure trust.
Pardon?
Pure trust.
Pure trust.
Yes, sir.
When I took the trusts and estates class in my third year of law school, that term was not in the book. Is that something new? Ordinarily, what you'd have is a trust, and there'd be a trust instrument. And
it's as new as California Supreme Court case Goldwater versus Altman from the 20s and 30s.
So there,
and what a pure trust is, it's very simple. You have certificates showing you're a beneficiary in the trust, and the people that hold the beneficiary's certificates can't order and can't vote and can't tell the trustees what to do. That's what a pure equity trust is, pure and simple. And the code has this 7701 classification definitions where they tell you whether what your entity is, whether it's a trust or whatever. These pure equity trusts don't fall into that.
Was it referred to as a pure equity trust or a pure trust? The record seems to say pure trust, and I don't know whether there's a distinction without a difference or what.
There's just an extra word with equity.
I don't know what it
that's
means.
That's all it means. A pure trust means the same thing as pure equity trust. Massachusetts business
I don't know what
trust
it means. Types. Is there a trust instrument?
Yes. Certainly is. And they're in evidence. I could provide you that also, but I don't have it off the top of my head, but they are in evidence. So we're used
Mr.
to
Mr. Eisen, unless my colleagues have any immediate questions, we'll hear now from Ms. Fusilier. Is that the way you say it?
Thank you, Your Honor.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Struggling to try to cover a lot of material.
We understand.
Good morning, Your Honors. Gretchen Fusilier on behalf of Appellant Teresa Manhart Giordano, and I intend to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
Ms. Giordano's position is totally different from the co-defendants with whom she was on trial. She performed, and the government indicates in their brief as well, nothing more than clerical services. She was working for a law office on the same floor where she...
Didn't she write letters to clients?
That is a misnomer, Your Honor. She did not write letters. The World We the People organization that was promoting the Pure Trust and the program, which Mr. Eisen has been addressing in his First Amendment argument, had presented template letters in their books. Those template letters had been or were available to anyone who had the books. All of the persons who were referred to Mr. Giordano's legitimate secretarial business, they had made the decision to file those zero returns before ever coming in contact with Ms. Giordano, before even knowing her name. She was not involved in either the publication, the distribution, the sale, the encouragement to file. She merely inserted into the template letters that were in the books that they had purchased their names, addresses, and Social Security numbers. In turn, the filers made the further determination to mail those to the IRS. She did not mail those to the IRS.
So that couldn't be considered by the jury an act in furtherance of the conspiracy, inserting those letters into the books?
Ms. Giordano did not insert those letters into the books.
What did she? You just said she did something with the letters. Maybe I misunderstood.
The letters were template letters,
right,
that the zero filers. The letters were template letters, and they existed in books that had been published by Lynn Meredith.
So what they need her for? What they need Giordano for?
Yeah.
They have the book already. They have the template already, and all she does is fill in the name, address, and Social Security number. What would they come to her for?
One of the filers indicated that he went to her because he didn't want to do it himself, because he thought that he would not produce the same kind of a professional letter that existed in the book.
And she did that for...
She had a secretarial business. This was not her only source of clientele.
Mm-hmm.
She had other clients. So the clients that came to her, she would use those template letters. She did not customize them. She did not modify them. She
inserted information into them.
That's all she did. She inserted limited information.
Which enabled them then to rely on the letters, rely on the book. Is that right?
They had relied on the book before coming to
she helped them,
to her.
But
no, she did
them?
Not help them.
She didn't help them in the process.
No, she did nothing. She did nothing that they could not have done on their own.
But
she
they,
provided
but,
nothing
but
that
the
they.
The point that they didn't do it on their own, and that she did it for them.
Well,
isn't that what happened?
They could have gone to a friend, and if
I,
a friend had printed
that.
It out,
Ms.
the Fusilier, friend would have.
I agree with that, but that's not what happened. What happened is that she did, in fact, help them. Is that right or wrong? Isn't that what you're saying?
Well, I don't think that she helped them in whatever they were intending to do with the IRS.
Let me add an extra feature to what Judge Marbley just indicated. Paragraph 4 in the indictment says, Defendant Teresa Manhart Giordano also served as a paralegal who would charge taxpayers a fee for drafting protest correspondence on their behalf to the IRS after the taxpayers had encountered problems with the IRS as a result of following defendants' advice. Is that false?
Your Honor, again, where is that reference?
I'm sorry, it's on page, the GER reference is 2, it's also page 2, and it's paragraph 4, starting at line 13 of the indictment.
Yes, that was not proven at trial. It is untrue that she drafted protest correspondence. She
okay,
did not.
And that was drafting, so the taxpayers who followed the advice ran into problems with the IRS. They'd bring it to her. She'd charge them a fee, right?
They would go to We the People.
Okay, but they worked with her,
they were
and there was a fee charged for her service, right?
The secretarial service was conducted by Mr. Giordano.
Okay, so she charged a fee.
She charged $50, I
okay,
believe.
Okay, and the fee was charged to respond to the problems that the folks who followed the Pure Trust approach had with the IRS. Is that correct?
Well, she did insert their name, address, and Social Security number. That was it, and
okay.
Printed it out.
But those were responses to the problems they had, right? They were formed, but they were responses, and there was a fee charged.
They were the responses that they chose her to insert their name and address and Social Security name into.
Yeah, the fact that somebody else could have done this doesn't change the fact that that was part of the process that was built into this arrangement. If there were a problem, they come to the We the People organization and they help you out. Isn't that correct?
Well, we go back to the intent, I believe, to answer that question. And we have the government witness, Tony Smith, who was an insider with the We the People organization. She and Betty Erickson worked very intimately with We the People. Ms. Smith testified that Giordano, actually following the same program that was proposed by her, by We the People, never indicated anything other than that if what Lynn is indicating and the citations in her book are true, then this is fine.
Wait. For a sufficiency of evidence challenge, the evidence has to be taken most favorably to the government. So it really doesn't matter what Giordano admitted or what the other defendants admitted if the jury could infer that Giordano played a larger role than just being a scribe. And I am wondering why the jury couldn't infer from the kind of money Giordano was making, more than $200,000 in one year and high six figures or high 100,000s in other years, that she must have been doing a lot more than just being a scribe filling in a couple blanks.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the figure that you're referring to, the government has conceded that there was some error in the determination of the amount that she made relative to the assistance in putting
they
the information in
error,
and
but
other
clients.
Other
they have clients. Conceded some error, but I think the scale, the magnitude of it is still she's making well into the six figures. And claiming all I did was fill in a couple blanks on templates. Why couldn't the jury draw an inference that she must be lying about that?
Well, when we consider the standard of care, yes, we do consider the evidence in the light most favorable to the prosecution. However, after determining that, we, or you, must determine whether or not the inferences were rationally made by the jury. And when you see that the jury acquitted Erickson and Moore, Erickson being the right-hand woman for Lynn Meredith, assisting in selling books, urging the purchase of trust, assisting at the seminars, and more, actually urging people to buy more trust, indicating, misrepresenting, if you would, according to the
concept. Was there evidence
concept.
They made this kind of money? I mean, if I want to know what role somebody plays in an organization. If he puffs it at a bar when he's trying to impress a girl, I figure that's not very persuasive. And if he minimizes it at trial, saying, I hardly did anything, I was just nothing in this organization, well, that may not be persuasive. And the money they pay him to do whatever it is that he does may be the most persuasive thing.
Well, if that's the most persuasive thing, Smith actually left WTP and started a comparable business on her own doing the same thing. However, the jury acquitted Moore, who was the right-hand woman, acquitted Erickson, acquitted
Erickson. Were they making the same kind of money as Giordano when they worked for this organization?
Your Honor, I don't recall whether or not the income was comparable, but their participation was active as opposed to the benign activity that Mr. O'Donnell was performing. And I think when you look at what she did not do, she did not urge the purchase of Pure Trust. She was honest with the persons who came to her. For example, Mr. Stambaugh. He indicated that she mentioned to him that she considered herself lucky because she was following the same program and had not been harassed by the government or the IRS. She also indicated to him honestly that other persons were having problems with the IRS. There was the testimony of Ms. Osborne, who was the representative called by the government, and she represented the government, indicating that in looking at Ms. Giordano's personal the taxpayer's personal file, that there would have been an indication of some action taken against her in the form of executing levies, etc., but nothing was in her file. So,
Ms. Fosilier, you're well over your time. Unless any of my colleagues have questions, we'll thank you for your argument, and we'll now hear from the government in the person of Mr. Andre, I believe.
And may I just say that I do join in the First Amendment argument of Mr. Eisen.
We will consider it so joined.
Thank you. May it please the Court. Jean-Claude Andre on behalf of the United States in this case. As the Court noted at the outset, there are a lot of issues, and so I, at least for now, absent indication to the contrary from the Court, I will follow Mr. Eisen and Ms. Fusilier.
Can I focus on one that jumps out at me right away? Jury instruction number 55 is very brief, so I'll just read it. It says, nor is the government required to prove an intent to evade or defeat any taxes. It's on the misdemeanor charge.
Yes, sir.
And 26 U.S.C. 7203 indicates that particular statute applies to an individual who, in quotes, willfully fails to pay such estimated tax or taxes and so on. How do you reconcile the difference between the instruction, which indicated that there was no requirement to prove an intent to evade, and the willfulness requirement of Section 7203?
Okay. Those instructions, or the various instructions that I think Ms. Giordano briefed, those instructions deal with different elements. There are, of course, three different elements for a 7203 charge.
Mm-hmm.
Whether there is a duty to file in the first place,
right.
Whether the taxpayer did not file,
right.
And then whether the taxpayer willfully failed to file.
Right.
And so the requirement that, or at least the lack of an intent to evade, runs to the first element, where the question simply is one of math.
Now, on what do you rely for that assignment of meaning? Why doesn't intent stand separately as far as willfulness is concerned?
Oh, no, it would. And the court did also instruct on the intent to evade when it defined it willfully.
Where in the record did the court's instruction in number 55 indicate that there was a requirement of willfulness?
I believe it was actually in instruction 50 or 53, Your Honor.
Where that is in the record?
One moment, please.
Sure.
GER 914.
Correct. Well, GER 914 sets forth the three elements of defense. If you look at GER 918, that's instruction 53, which talks about the duty to file.
Mm-hmm.
And then GER 920 is also another pertinent instruction. I'm actually going to pull that volume.
Okay. I gather your point is that even though the instruction number 55 did not cover it, another instruction did, and you think that was adequate to cover the requirements of 7203.
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, now that I do have this particular page, GER 920,
mm-hmm.
and this is the instruction
for the crime of willful failure to file a tax return. Mm-hmm. The very last sentence of that instruction says, the term willfully as used herein is defined elsewhere in these instructions. And, of course, the court did previously give a cheek willfulness instruction.
And that's on 920, is that correct?
920, right.
Okay. All right, great. So from the government's perspective, 55 doesn't stand alone. You have to include these other instructions, 50 and 53, and that since that referred back, that takes care of the willfulness requirement.
Yes, because, of course, it made some sense for Judge Ferguson to do that in this case because willfulness, or cheek willfulness, was an element of both the 371 conspiracy charge
right.
as well as the misdemeanor failures to file.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. I think that I follow you, but the seeming irreconcilability of 50 and 55 still a bit haunts me. So could you give me a word or two on why those are not irreconcilable? Because 50 requires a showing of willful intent to evade taxes. Is that right?
Correct.
And then 55 states that the government need not prove intent to evade or defeat taxes. They seem to be incongruous on their face.
Perhaps we're speaking about different instructions, and I apologize. Instruction 55 says the government is not required to show that a tax is due and owing. And, of course, that makes sense because the duty to file is triggered by gross income, not net income. And so you could have a case where a defendant has a triggering gross income. They have to file a return.
Right.
They don't.
You know, I think Judge Marbley and I are starting with the same thing. Here's 55 right here. It says, for the crime of willful failure to file a tax return, the government is not required to show that a tax is due and owing from the defendant, nor is the government required to prove an intent to evade or defeat any taxes. That doesn't refer back to anything else.
No.
Nor does anything else necessarily refer to that because it's very specific about this crime, which is under 7203.
Right, and it's because the defendant, for whatever reason, let's say, let's take like an Al Capone type example.
Okay.
You have someone who just doesn't want to be on the federal government's radar, even though they may not, in fact, be trying to evade taxes. They just don't want the government looking in their books. And so there, the government doesn't have to show an intent to actually evade taxes. The government has to show a willful refusal to file a return that otherwise is required based on the gross income. Maybe Al Capone is a bad example, but you know, some kind of criminal where
might be a good one. He said he never made any money; it was all show. That he had business expenses that ate up all his income.
But that's my point. It's that you know there are a number of reasons why someone may not want to file a tax return, and if they know that they have that duty and they don't do so, it's irrelevant whether they actually had, we're going to get a refund, we're going to owe no taxes, we're going to owe taxes. And I hope that answers the court's question.
Help me on Giordano for a moment. We may come back to this, though.
Sure.
Taking the evidence most favorably to the government, what enabled the jury to conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that she was guilty of the crime charged and that she wasn't merely a scribe?
Sure, Your Honor. First of all, Giordano was not just a scribe filling in names into forms. Certainly, there was a large component of her conduct that can be described that way. But she interacted with these clients that were referred to her by We the People, and based on the information that they sent her relating to their tax problems, she would then sell them one or another, or sometimes multiple rounds of documents. And so while that may not be down in the weeds tax advice, she certainly was engaging in more than just saying, oh, you want me to take page 23 of Lynn Meredith's book and type it up pretty on my word processor and insert your name. Additionally, as Judge Kleinfeld, you pointed out, her income skyrocketed as a result of the scheme. And contrary to
based on the information the clients gave her in their individual personal interaction, she decided which of the templates to use?
She would make a recommendation to them as to what they should buy, whether it should be a $40 letter packet or a more expensive motion packet. And it also depended on where these clients were in the stream. Were they just getting a notice of deficient tax return from the IRS, or were they already at, for example, the notice of intent to levy stage?
Was she trained by Ms. Meredith?
Yes, she was. She was trained by Ms. Meredith. And I don't want to both, I don't want to undersell that or oversell that. I think Ms. Meredith showed her how to use the templates that we admit Ms. Meredith created and put on the computer. But they also interacted. They worked in the same office originally a couple days a week for a couple years, and then Giordano came in more and more regularly. And she sat next to Tony Smith, and over time she eventually started actually even handling customer complaint calls.
Were there any instances in the record where she individualized these letters, got it out of the template other than just name, address, and social security number?
I'm not aware of any, Your Honor. The one other thing that she did do, contrary to Ms. Fusilier's claim that she did things that only these clients could do on their own, she notarized documents for them that they weren't even present for. So, I mean, not only do you have her performing a specialized function, she's also doing it in contravention to her duties to the state of California as a notary, which when you add up the total mix, along with the other evidence I'm about to discuss, certainly allows a rational jury to conclude that she had the requisite criminal intent.
Was there, California requires notaries to have a book.
Yes.
In which the person whose signature is being notarized signs, if there's real property involved, they have to do a thumbprint and the like. Did she do that with any of these folks?
I don't know how. We did not seize her book.
Okay, so that was not an evidence then. Okay.
No, it's not an evidence. I mean, but certainly clients of hers who testified at trial said that they paid her their fee to get this correspondence to the IRS or the motion packet and got it back from her with the notary seal and her signature already on it.
Okay, so there's independent evidence that she did that. And I guess with respect to Ms. Giordano, that's really just a conspiracy point there. Charging her with, right? Is that correct, or were there separate?
There also were failures to file as well.
Failures to file, okay, right.
We charged the conspiracy and then separate failures to file against all the defendants. With respect to Ms. Fusilier's point that the government's concession on restitution somehow undercuts our reliance on her skyrocketing income, I don't believe that that will hold any water. If you look at, and this is in the GESR, the thin sealed volume of government's excerpts, that is where Ms. Giordano made her proffer of various tax returns that she was going to file or had filed in advance of sentencing to clean up her tax obligations with the IRS. And certainly those income numbers on the face sheet, because that's all she provided, she did not provide full tax returns for any of the years, just the front page. The business income numbers are certainly lower than the loss numbers that the government relied on at trial with the summary witnesses. But we don't have the Schedule Cs to know, I guess as with Al Capone, what kind of business deductions she was claiming were eating up all of her net income, all of her gross income. So I don't think it undermines confidence. And if you do look at the numbers, they're still quite high. They're all in excess of $50,000, some years up over $100,000. Either way, she's making a lot of money over this. And it certainly allows a rational juror to conclude that she had a motive for doing what she was doing. On that restitution point, though, we acknowledge that the proffer of those tax returns requires her restitution issue to go back.
I'm trying to sort out here picture Giordano. Sometimes in third world countries you have public scribes, and people come to them and say, I want to write a letter to my husband saying I love him very much. And the scribe may do that verbatim or may make up her own flowery letter and write it. That's not this situation. Sometimes people go to a law office in a particular specialty where exact words have to be used again and again, like, say, in a warranty deed or a deed of trust. And there, the lawyer may just dictate to a secretary, or I don't know if they dictate anymore. They probably do it on their computer now. What name and address and such to fill in the blanks, but the lawyer decides whether it should be a warranty deed or a quitclaim deed or a deed of trust or some other sort of document. And there's a whole lot of judgment and discretion that the lawyer is exercising. I gather Giordano was somewhere between somebody who just mechanically fills in what somebody tells him and the lawyer who's exercising all that judgment. What did the evidence show about what she did?
Well, the evidence showed, for example, that I believe it was victim or client Dreckholm, that when he went to her and told him about the problem she was having, she said, you should try this motion packet for $455 instead of just the correspondence letter. I mean, I agree. She's somewhere in between those points. Okay, she's probably closer to the scribe bookend than the lawyer bookend. But even with that being the case, the evidence was still sufficient in light of the deference that this court owes the jury verdicts under Jackson and Nevels.
Because so the key here is she tells him, don't do the $40 deal, do the $455 deal.
Right, based on the information he is providing. And, of course, with all of her clients, part of what she's doing is she's telling them, send me the correspondence you're receiving from the IRS so I can, you know, give you the appropriate form. And again, it doesn't require a lot of judgment. I acknowledge it's fairly formulaic. But she is not just simply taking a dictation and typing it up. There is more interaction.
For purposes of the conspiracy count, would she have had to do any more than to correspond with clients and recommend one of these packets? Would that have been sufficient to convict her?
I think for profit.
For conspiracy, yeah.
Yes, for profit. And I'll add, with the requisite knowledge. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, when I look at Ms. Giordano's case, I've always thought that Ms. Fusilier's best claim is that she has insufficient knowledge. We still think we gave enough circumstantial evidence to the jury for the jury to reject that. I mean, that's really a Neville's Step 2 analysis, not a Neville's Step 1. And the knowledge would come from the fact that she was looking at all of her clients' correspondence from the IRS, where the IRS was steadfastly saying, this isn't working, this isn't working. She had her own dealings with the IRS, and the government disagrees with Ms. Fusilier's characterization of the interaction with Kevin Stambaugh. In Ms. Giordano's testimony, in Kevin Stambaugh's testimony, he was first asked about the protest correspondence and the motion packets. And he then said, Giordano said she'd been doing this for years and was not being bothered. Now, later, he also said what Ms. Fusilier quotes, which is that, you know, he wasn't being harassed by the IRS. Well, okay, so you have two pieces of testimony that you could parse differences from. That's what the jury is there to do. The testimony we're relying on is that he said she had told him she was filing this kind of correspondence with the IRS and was not being bothered. And, in fact, six months earlier, she had a notice of intent to levy sent to her.
So for purposes of Jackson and Neville, it's really kind of a closed issue, or as the government's concerned, because even though this evidence may not have been fulsome, it did tie her to that. The jury weighed the opposite position that was advanced by the defense and chose not to believe it. Is that a fair summation?
Exactly, Your Honor. Exactly, Your Honor. That this was a triable case, particularly for Ms. Giordano, but we produced enough evidence to show that she was a knowing participant in the scheme and that the jury could reject her claim, which is basically what she's arguing here as well, that she was, you know, duped or seduced by Lynn Meredith with Lynn Meredith's fancy ideas about tax evasion.
Let me ask you about those ideas. I think there probably is a First Amendment defense if somebody is charged with conspiracy with their literary agent and publisher to cause people to evade taxes if all they do is write a book. I'm not sure whether it's clear or not from the way the case was presented to the jury whether Meredith and the others could have been convicted on account of a bad book. My problem with books that say false things, they can be just grossly, outrageously false. And I still think there's a First Amendment protection. My gosh, I bought Marx's Das Kapital and I bought Hitler's Mein Kampf. I've also bought numerous books that are less egregious, but I think two-thirds of the books I buy on current affairs have all sorts of nonsense in them. Surely there's a First Amendment protection for that. Was it clear to the jury that they couldn't be convicted just because of the book?
I believe it was, Your Honor. I mean, the court is...
Why? Show me exactly. The book did go to the jury as an exhibit, as evidence.
Yes, a number of different editions of the book.
And the nice thing about something like that is it's concrete. And it's nonsense.
Just to tag on to Judge Kleinfeld's question, the book was presented to the jury for what purpose, or the books?
It was part of an integrated scheme. I mean, and so our position is that, and well, I can take one little digression. Mr. Eisen has mentioned the Schiff case, which fortunately I'm prepared to address, even though it wasn't cited in the briefs. I actually think the Schiff case pretty much is the end of any challenge to the indictment in this case. The Schiff case would be 379 F3rd 621. That's a prior restraint preliminary injunction case from this court from 2004, where the court enjoined the release of a book called The Federal Mafia, which basically is Lynn Meredith's book. And while Schiff may have been doing other things, the fact that it's a prior restraint preliminary injunction case means it really was just about the book. And, of course, as we all know, prior restraints are even more disfavored.
Worries me just relying on that because it's not a Supreme Court decision, and it is a prior restraint on a book. It's really kind of sticking our chin out there.
Well, I realize that, but it is a binding precedent of this court. And
I agree.
And you know, prior restraints are more disfavored than
precedents can be limited or distinguished sometimes, so I want to be confident that it's right.
I understand that, Your Honor. I've read it a number of times and don't see how it really can be distinguished. And there the court said this is fraudulent commercial speech, and so we're done. The court also recognized the two analyses that we were relying, or we relied on below, and that we were relying on here, which are that this is incitement speech and solicitation speech, and therefore the defendants are, at the indictment stage, stripped of First Amendment protections.
I don't think I made my question clear enough to you.
My apologies.
If it's the book in combination with the counseling and the filling in of forms and the mailing off of forms, that's one thing. The book may be evidence of intent and all sorts of stuff in connection with those things. But if the jury can convict on the book alone, even if it thinks somebody didn't do all those other things, that's where I have to really confront Schiff.
Correct.
And I'm wondering, could the jury convict just on the book?
I have the First Amendment instruction from Your Honor, and I
have it too, 39 GDR 901. Is that what you're looking at?
Yes, and I will concede that as I stand here, I'm not sure. We certainly didn't argue the case that way, and I don't recall the court ever giving an instruction that says.
Have you argued the book?
We argued it as part of this integrated scheme that, you know, that the defendants, or that Lynn Meredith wrote this book. It contained lies. She went and put on seminars where she peddled the book and then peddled the trusts that were discussed in the book. And in fact, in one occasion, when we had an undercover agent go to one of these seminars, they offered a special deal if you go over to the table and buy the trust right then and there. And that then, if people were having problems with either the zero income aspect of their program, which was detailed in earlier versions of the book, or with the trust, that then you could come back to them and they would refer you to Giordano, who would charge you for the letters that then would be sent into the IRS. And so when you have this full integrated scheme, yes, on some level it's...
There was a professor a couple of years ago by the name of Belisles, and he wrote a book saying that in colonial America, nobody had their own guns. They kept them down at the armory and people died. They had no guns. And he went around giving a lot of lectures to that effect. And what's more, he was promoting activity, which was the deprivation of what the Supreme Court decided in Heller were constitutional rights. But I can't imagine that Professor Belisles could be indicted for lying in his book. And the evidence later came out that he just flat lied. He said he'd looked at estates that were in probated, and he hadn't. The records didn't exist. He just lied.
Right. The old county records office and all
that. That's right.
Decades before. I'm familiar with the story. I think the critical distinction is that his conduct there, or the money he made, was from selling the book, just to Oxford Press. It was a reputable press. And then from his speaking tours.
But he probably made a whole lot of money from speaking tours. Universities sometimes pay celebrity speakers as much as $50,000 just to come and give a talk.
Absolutely. But those two acts, the full universe of what he did was speech, and arguably, you know, pure speech. Whereas here, once you start dabbling in providing forms that if you know they're false, then again, you're in the fraudulent commercial speech area if you're charging for that. But then also you're inciting people to commit lawless acts. And contrary to Mr. Eisen's claim, there was a lot of interaction. I mean, the fact that they had offices where clients would come in and discuss the pure trusts and then would have the employees of We the People and the Sovereignty Pure Trust act as trustees for the trust, that's just a level of involvement that transcends pure advocacy and I'm sure transcends what Professor Belial did.
What about the imminence argument that Mr. Eisen made? What type of bright line rules should we look at? Would 3 weeks still fall in the range of imminence?
Or would you have to do a deeper dive, as Judge Kleinfeld has suggested, because this is something that takes a little, this is one of those crimes that takes a little bit more time to perfect than throwing a Molotov cocktail on it.
No, absolutely. I'm not going to sit here and try to jam this case into Brandenburg. They're really apples and oranges. I don't have a bright line rule to offer. I think the courts need to take a pragmatic approach to it when we're talking about, you know, fraud, white collar crimes where the imminence is measured or is perhaps, you know, immeasurable. Because there's necessarily built into it some kind of potential for cooling off.
I want to follow up on this, on jury instruction number 39. The instruction clearly acknowledges a First Amendment right to speak, and specifically here, this means that the expression of a belief that a law is invalid or unconstitutional is protected by the First Amendment. But then it goes on to indicate that the defendant's arguments here are protected unless one of the following are present. One, the defendant intended to incite others to imminently file false claims for refunds or to hide their income from the IRS. Now, the imminent gets to the concept that Mr. Eisen mentioned. Is it the government's position that, assuming for a moment that there were no filing of forms, no helping with protest, nothing else. Let's just say there was a book out there, this particular book. Would that book in and of itself meet the requirements of this subparagraph 1 of the jury instruction number 39?
I think it would be, I think it both could and it could not based on the particular facts framing it. In other words, the publication of the book would not be enough. But if someone bought the book and went out and immediately followed it, then I think it would satisfy.
So from your perspective, just the book alone, I understand from a conspiracy perspective, we got all these other things that the entity was doing and that the people were doing. But just the book alone, I go to the seminar, I buy the book, and I have it there, and I don't look at it right away, but it comes tax time. I look at this, and I say, oh, the government just drives me crazy. I can't stand this. This makes a lot of sense to me, and so I follow that. I set up a trust, and I do all the things that are indicated there. Does that mean that the book alone meets that requirement of specifically here, I have been incited to imminently file false claims for refunds or to hide income?
I think the court's instruction, in particular, if we turn to the next page, protects against that situation. Because the court described the word imminently to me.
Is the word imminently quite near in time,
too? Quite near in time, too.
Uh-huh.
Now, I think this court's case law...
What does that mean?
Well, the judge left it up for the parties to argue. Mm-hmm. I think this court's case law actually allows for an even broader time period.
But certainly if you had the book for 2 years, that wouldn't, under anybody's definition, qualify as imminent, would it, under even this definition?
No, that's correct. But again,
was there any evidence introduced in this trial that showed how long after people attended the seminar and bought the book that they filed these returns?
Not that I recall, but there certainly were people who bought trusts pretty much on the spot because that was one of the reasons.
I understand. Well, that's the buying of the trust. The problem here is filing with the IRS.
Right, but I think that the trusts are... The trusts really are just they're the middle piece of the same triptych, in that in the cases that Mr. Eisen is attempting to distinguish, yes, you had people who were more actively involved in the preparation of tax returns, and I believe Mr. Eisen said something to the effect of, you know, none of these defendants were involved in the preparation of their clients' tax returns. No, but what they did instead is they solicited their clients into or incited their clients to buy these trusts, which then became the vehicle for filing a fraudulent tax return.
I understand. Well, what, you know what bothers me about this? I remember reading with horror the World War I prosecutions against people that were, you know, advocating against, you know, arming our country and going to war with Germany. And a lot of them were prosecuted. Now, that wouldn't happen today, but they were prosecuted for what they said. There was no proof of anybody ever having followed up on it. I think it was even Eugene Debs or somebody was indicted and convicted. And Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., of all people, agreed with it. This troubles me. I'm a little concerned about how this instruction squares, again, just looking at the book alone. I get the conspiracy part and all that sort of thing, but just the book alone and that instruction, I'm troubled by that. This concept that you can read this and if it incites people to not file a tax return, it is criminal. And yet, as Judge Kleinfeld indicated, we have people all over this country who make outrageous claims in books of all kinds that encourage people to, you know, to do any number of things, some natural, some unnatural, and it's just no problem at all. It's just part of free speech. Why isn't this the same?
Well,
absent the other stuff.
No, I understand. Because I think Judge Pragerson actually gave, at least under this court's current case law, which perhaps the en banc court or the Supreme Court might someday revisit, but his instruction is more limited than what this court approved of in Freeman. In fact, I mean, Freeman was discussed extensively during the 5.5 days that Judge Pragerson was going over jury instructions. And in that case, the court said that imminence is defined as a lawless act likely to occur. Well, that at least to me seems more remote than quite near in time. And, you know, so Judge Pragerson struggled with this. He tried to come up with an instruction that would account for the fact that this is not a mob scene. It's not Brandenburg. But at the same time, you do need some imminence. And I think that so this instruction, even if we just look at the book, it adequately gave the defendants the opportunity to argue that whatever their clients did, it was too remote, and the jury could resolve the case that way. It also gave the government the opportunity to come in and say, no. The defendants knew what they were advocating.
But there was no evidence of imminence, was there?
Well, I mean, there certainly is evidence in the you know, weeks and
the
months.
The buying of the trust. But, I mean, in terms, I want to be sure of this. Was there any evidence, as reflected in the record, that the government put in that showed that all or any of the taxpayers who bought this book acted on the advice of the book imminently?
I don't think we drilled down on it that way, Judge Smith.
Okay.
We probably could go back and divine it, because there were a number of the witnesses we brought in said that they came and actually went into the We the People offices to talk with Lynn Meredith after having bought the book and followed it. And so there certainly are people who bought the book and relied on it. We just haven't connected.
But going in to talk to Lynn Meredith was not in itself criminal.
Oh, no, but that was the entree to then purchasing a trust and purchasing Giordano's response.
Well, then does that intervening act somehow attenuate, the time period problem?
I don't think so, because again, to stick with this example.
So they read the book, they go and talk to Meredith, and then they do perform some criminal act. So does talking to Meredith break the chain at all?
If I could clarify the facts. In the example I'm talking about, and I know we've summarized these various witnesses in our brief, the defendant would read the book and then follow its rubric for example, the zero income tax return, send it in. And then it wouldn't work. And then they would go meet with Meredith to figure out what to do next. So the actual lawless act was in response to the
reading the book. And as I think you told Judge Smith, you don't know how much time there was between reading of the book and filing the zero income tax return.
No, not as I stand here today, although I'm happy to divine it if the court wants to invite us.
So then there's no evidence in the record from which a juror could glean imminence.
Well, I think there would be. Again, we didn't argue it that way because we didn't believe that this instruction.
Okay, well, why would that be? If you didn't adduce the evidence, where would the evidence come from?
Well, because, for example, some of our witnesses said, I bought the book, you know, in X month of X year.
Mm-hmm.
And then those same witnesses discussed their fraudulent tax returns with my colleagues when we were examining them. And those tax returns are signed and dated. And so the dates are there. So I said, we can divine whether there was imminence. It's just the issue wasn't kind of presented, or wasn't anything for us to focus on.
Well, no, what you can divine is the time period. But then wouldn't it be for the jury to determine whether that constituted imminence? Who determines imminence in this instance?
Well, in this instance, it was for the jury to make the call. But certainly, again, I'm not saying this is the case, but if I were to go back and look at all the records, I might be able to find an example where the witness said they bought the book in August 1997,
but to Judge Marbley's point, though, and to my earlier one, it stands to reason, does it not, if no evidence was introduced by the government about the time period between the purchase of the book and the filing of the false return, the imminence requirement could not be reasonably found by the jury. You can't deduce something from nothing, right?
No, that's a fair point. But we did argue this point, again, not in terms of dates or weeks or months, but we did argue that our victim witnesses bought the book, followed it, it didn't work, and then everything else that I've discussed. And they heard the testimony where they did mention dates and where the dates were on the tax return. So
do you have any defendants of these three who were convicted where they never went into the office and got any papers? All they did was buy the book, read the book, and follow the book?
I'm sorry, Judge Michael. Maybe don't understand.
Here's what I'm trying to figure out. I just don't buy your point that the book would be enough by itself. I just don't buy it. I don't see that imminence even comes into it. I mean, gosh, back in the days when I did my own taxes, I might have bought a tax book in May because it would be half price and not looked at it till the following March or April. When it was time to start working on my taxes. I'm thinking, does that matter in this case? And I've got these three people, Meredith and Bybee and Giordano, and could any of them have been convicted because someone bought the book and acted on it, and that's all? Or were all three of them in positions such that the overwhelming evidence was that somebody came in and they did forms for them or wrote letters for them or did something subsequent to the book was part of the conduct that was charged and proved?
Our position is that, and kind of unpack it into two separate questions, if I may. Our position is that, yes, theoretically, someone could have bought the book, acted upon it, and if they did so close in time, then these defendants could be prosecuted for the book. Now, of course,
the book alone.
The book alone. Of course, that's not what we have here. We do have this fully...
What we have here is what I was asking about.
And what we have here is this fully integrated scheme where there were all of these steps. And the only parts that are arguably even covered by the First Amendment are the book and the seminars. And so at that point, once you add it all up, that's just, you know, more than enough evidence for the jury to – it was enough to allow the defendants to get a First Amendment instruction, which was something that wasn't
on
unfair.
On Meredith, people came in and talked to her, and she did other papers for them when they came in and talked to her?
Yes, or sold them trust, told them lies.
Bybee did – people come in and talk to her,
yes.
and she did other papers for them,
yes.
After they came in?
Yes.
And Giordano, you've already said.
Yeah, Giordano, more closer to the scribe end, but yes.
So as we wind up here, we could talk about this case forever, and it's a very interesting case, but what would the government like us to do with the book part? I mean, you could tell we're all troubled by the book part. We really are. And the jury instruction is a jury instruction, and unless you can point me to something else, it seems pretty clear that the First Amendment instruction says there is this right, but you meet these exceptions, First Amendment is not going to help you. And the exceptions all deal with imminency, which is defined on the next page of the instruction. There's no evidence, so far as you've been able to indicate at this point, that any of the victims, we'll use that, your terminology, did that, that they looked at the book and imminently filed. What would you like us to do with that? You want us to look at it and I'm not saying we're going to do it. I'm just saying, if the government had its druthers, how would you have us treat the book as intent as part of the other things? And if so, how do you distinguish the effect of jury instruction number 39? Or do you want us to really consider the book in isolation? How do we deal with it?
I think the first part would be to say that under Schiff, the speech in the book, or the book itself, you know, can form the basis for prosecution because it's fraudulent commercial speech. The district court did not, although defendants complain about jury instruction, when in fact they don't actually complain. I just want to think I do need to point out, they don't actually complain about instruction 39. They are not renewing their objection to that instruction on appeal. But in any event, defendants complain about the First Amendment. They argue that any unlawful acts by the victim's clients were too remote. The district court, you know, certainly didn't abuse discretion in defining imminence the way it did in light of the fact that this book alone could have been the basis for prosecution under Schiff.
On the basis that it is fraudulent commercial speech.
But here the district court gave the jury an instruction which arguably elevated the government's burden and allowed the jury to reach the conclusion whether the victim's conduct after buying the book or after meeting with Meredith or after attending the seminar was sufficiently close in time, and we find no abuse of discretion in the court putting that question to the jury.
Well, the court's run you way over. Go ahead, Judge.
Do we need to cite Schiff? It strikes me as kind of a cert invitation to cite and follow Schiff, and I'm wondering whether we need to if we decide that you're correct on some of the ground.
Well, no, I don't think you do. I was trying to address Judge Smith's question narrowly. No, again, I think that you can cite Solomon, Shulman, Smith, George, Freeman, all the cases that we rely most heavily on for the proposition that when you have speech bundled with fraudulent profit-taking acts and interactions with individuals, you just are pretty much out of the First Amendment area. At most, it's a jury question. Judge Pragerson put it to the jury here. They rejected it based on sufficient evidence, and we're done.
Thank you very much all for your argument today. The case just argued is submitted, and the court is adjourned for the day.
Thank you very much.